Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning with France on the cusp of crisis. The Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, has rammed through Parliament without a vote a controversial new social security budget. In a restive National Assembly, Mr. Barnier said that he had decided to use a special constitutional provision to get the budget adopted.
Les Français appellent et attendent de la stabilité.
The French people are calling for and expect stability, are calling for and expect transparency for businesses and for daily lives, at a point when our country has so much to do to defend its interests and its influence in Europe and in the world. That's why, in the framework of the Constitution, I commit the responsibility of the government, of my government, on the entirety of the Social Security Budget Bill for 2025.
Well, you heard the Prime Minister say at the start there that the French people are calling for and expecting stability. That seems to be the last thing on offer, at least when it comes to the politics of this, because the two big blocks of parties on the hard left and hard right now say they will vote to bring the government down within days, probably just later this week. And they have the numbers to do that, all of which leaves France facing political upheaval at a time when it's also in a deep economic hole. Let's hear first from one of the members of Parliament who will be backing the imminent no-confidence motion in the government. Nathalie Auziol is with the hard-left France Insoumise, or France Unbowed Party. What can be achieved by bringing down the government now?
We are in a deep, huge political crisis, which is even a crisis in the regime in France. And it has been so since July the 7th, when Macron decided not to respect the result of the snap elections and decided to appoint a right-wing prime minister in spite of the victory of the new Popular Front. So this was the first problem. And now Prime Minister Barnier decided to use the 49.3 article of the Constitution. Why? Because he has no majority in the National Assembly to pass his budget bills. And so here we are. We have already, with the new Popular Front, backed up a no-confidence motion when Barnier was appointed Prime Minister. And we will obviously vote this no-confidence motion again on Wednesday.
Because the
instability and the crisis we are in is due to Macron and his illegitimate government. That's a matter of fact.
Right. And I hear your argument, and I know that you've opposed this government from the get-go because, as you say, that you came first in those elections, although, you know, there are roughly three blocks within within the National Assembly. The point is, though, if you're saying, you know, the country needs stability, this is not going to deliver it. You're sort of making a point to say that you're unhappy with this government and with this budget, but it's not actually going to improve the situation for the French economy, is it?
One sure thing is that this government has not led to any form of stability, that Macron's politics has not led to any form of stability, and that it has worsened in the last months.
Because politicians such as you are not affording it any chance to actually make the changes that are so necessary?
But because there is a radical opposition, there is a radical difference between the budget which was presented by Barnier, which would lead to further cuts in public services, in healthcare, in the increase in pensions, and so on and so forth. And we, with the new Popular Front, had managed to have many amendments voted and to have a transformation into a new budget conform to our program, which we were elected to defend, because the new Popular Front has a majority in the National Assembly.
Well, it doesn't have a majority, does it? I mean, you may have the largest bloc, but it's certainly some way short of an overall majority in the Assembly.
Well, a short majority is still a majority. And just to remind, from 2022 to 2024, Macron's group of MPs were a short majority as well. which did not prevent them from implementing their politics. So why did the rule change now? This is not a democratic way of doing things. So obviously we are in a radical opposition to Macron's politics, and my belief is that in a sane democracy, when you ask people to vote, the basic rule is to respect the people's democratic expression through this vote.
Nathalie Auziol from the left-wing France Insoumise Party. Under the constitution, there can't actually be fresh elections to the parliament until next July. So can President Macron keep this government in place even if there is a no-confidence vote? It was a question I put to Sophie Pedder, Paris bureau chief of The Economist.
He can keep the government on in a sort of caretaking role. It wouldn't be able to do anything different or new or significant. All it could do is keep things ticking over, keep civil servants paid, and keep pensions going into people's accounts. So it would be something that would be seen as a stopgap solution, and Macron would be under quite a lot of pressure to move fast and name a new prime minister. But the kind of underlying problem, and it's one that your previous guest wasn't quite sort of willing to concede, and that is there is no majority in parliament. So whoever Macron looks to name and ask to form a new government is going to be faced with exactly the same problem that Barnier has had. You know, he inherited an almost impossible situation, tried to put together a budget, tried to find compromises right up to the last minutes before this afternoon in the National Assembly. But it's very, very difficult. You know, France doesn't have any culture of sort of coalition building or of compromise. There are three very hostile blocs in Parliament, which are unwilling to talk to each other. And as long as that stays the case, it's very difficult for whoever Macron names. That's the difficulty.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the political difficulty. And meanwhile, I mean, the markets are looking in, I mean, some disdain at what is happening with France having already a massive fiscal hole to plug. And it appears no easy way of so doing.
Well, that's exactly the problem, and that's the pressure on Barnier's government. You know, the deficit is heading this year for over 6% of GDP. He had wanted to get it down to 5% for next year. That budget itself will be in the bin if Barnier is voted down on Wednesday, and France will be back to square one in trying to do anything about it. I mean, the markets have been a bit wary. I would say they haven't been panicking. You know, it's been a sort of cautious, you know, cautious sort of response rather than an excessive response. But France is under pressure. There's no doubt about it. And it's under pressure at a time from the markets, but also at the time from the European Commission, from ratings agencies, from anybody, any of the outside observers to try and get its public finances in order.
And just back to the politics of this, finally, does the National Rally, the hard right group on the right, does it pay any price for this? And does Marine Le Pen, the leader of the group, pay any price?
It's a really interesting question, because if you look at what she's been doing over the last few months, she's been trying to pursue this strategy of making herself look respectable. So wanting to make the party not look like a party of protest, but a party of government in waiting. And this, the decision to back the no confidence motion, I think is a real kind of reversal of that. And I think will be seen by some of her new voters, perhaps not the kind of traditional electorate that she's always appealed to, but the sort of new white collar workers who have flocked to her, maybe thinking, well, hang on a sec, is she quite as sort of respectful of, you know, the national interest as all that, or is she really after pursuing her own interest in all of this? So it's a gamble she's taking with her own future as well.
And that was Sophie Pedder, Paris bureau chief, The Economist. Last week, you may have heard the campaign group, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, come on NewsHour to explain why they were taking the Norwegian government to court over plans to allow deep-sea mining in its waters. WWF warned that the attempt to extract minerals would cause huge environmental damage. Well, now the government in Oslo has announced that it's suspending its plans to open its seabeds to commercial exploitation, to the relief of the junior partners in the governing coalition, the Socialist Left Party. Lars Haltbrekken is one of their members of parliament and indeed the party's environmental spokesman. Why does he think it's the right decision?
This was an agreement that we made with the government this weekend. We think it will have enormous environmental consequences to go for minerals in the deep sea. All the environmental advice that the government got last year from its own professionals warned against deep sea mining, mainly because we don't know how huge the cost and consequences for the environment will be.
One of the arguments that is in favour of this type of mining is that what the government is looking for are the sort of minerals that are absolutely critical for green technology. I mean, I think their argument would be, look, it is a balance between risk and reward. We don't want to cause unnecessary environmental damage, but we have to do more to try and make that transition towards green energy.
Yeah, and we need more minerals and metals for the green shift, but we cannot start deep sea mining with the enormous environmental consequences that might have. We should recycle more the metals and minerals that is already in use, and we could also have mining onshore with strict environmental regulations.
I'm sure you're aware that mining on land is often stands accused of causing huge environmental damage itself, and also sourcing minerals from mines around the world. I mean, that you can be sourcing them from countries that you would rather not necessarily deal with.
Yeah, that's right. And there are a lot of huge environmental consequences with mining on land as well. And there should be done under very, very strict environmental regulations, much stricter than today. But this cannot be used as an argument to go for deep sea mining. And we also see that large companies, for instance, car companies, say that we will not buy the minerals from deep sea mining. And even large financial institutions in Norway and elsewhere say that we will not invest in deep sea mining because of the environmental consequences we have. We should instead start to clean up the mining industry on land, and we should start recycling the metals and minerals that are already in use.
And that was Lars Haltbrekken from the Norwegian Socialist Left Party, welcoming the fact that the government, of which his party is a junior member, has decided to suspend its plans to open up the Norwegian seabed to mining. This is NewsHour. Coming up the programme, we'll find out what Turkey might hope to gain from backing a rebel army in Syria.
The Turkish main goals in Syria, in terms of having a political solution, is much more feasible now, as the approach from to normalize Assad without any political solution in Syria is dead as of now. Everyone now understands that this is not a possible way forward.
More on that in just over 15 minutes. Headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. Hezbollah has attacked an Israeli army post in occupied Lebanese territory as both sides accuse each other of violating a ceasefire agreed last week. And French opposition parties say that they will bring down Michel Barnier's minority government within days after he forced his social security budget through Parliament without a vote. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Joe Biden has done what he said he would not do. He has issued a full and unconditional pardon for his son, Hunter, who early this year was convicted for illegally buying a gun and lying about his drug use, and then for tax evasion. He could have faced jail on either count. This was what President Biden said back in June.
I'm extremely proud of my son, Hunter. He has overcome an addiction. He's one of the brightest, most decent men I know. And I am satisfied that I'm not going to do anything. I said I'd abide by the jury decision, and I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
Jasmine Crockett is a Democratic member of Congress from Texas. She is backing Joe Biden over his decision to issue a pardon. Why?
The first part of this answer for me simply goes back to tracking this prosecution as someone who serves on the oversight committee and saw what the oversight committee was doing and the fact that they were really reeling against the president and his family in an attempt to make sure that they could set up the now newly elected president to be reelected. This was really nothing more than a political prosecution. As someone who has practiced criminal defense for almost two decades prior to entering Congress, I know what federal prosecutions as well as state prosecutions look like. And this isn't what it normally looks like. I'm sure we would be hard pressed to find one other person in the entire United States that has been prosecuted for what Hunter was prosecuted for and put through the ringer, especially after he agreed to enter a plea of guilty. So that's number one. Number two, when we're talking about, you know, how is it that President Biden should go about this? Well, here's the reality. We know that the former president, soon to be next president, has promised that he is going to make sure that he does the exact same thing for insurrectionists, people that came up against the United States, people that tried to tear us apart and tear apart our democracy. And as far as I'm concerned, they're still trying to tear our democracy apart. Number two, we know that he had so many personal friends that had engaged in criminal activities and he was going about making sure that they could be pardoned. And number three, we know that on his way out, he was actually trying to figure out whether or not he could pardon himself for crimes. So let me be clear. This is a father and a president that did what was right, not only by his son, but also did right to basically correct what I would consider to be a wrong.
Right. I mean, in terms of what President Trump may have done and may now be about to do, I mean, that's a separate issue. We're talking about what President Biden is responsible for. I mean, firstly, he said he wasn't going to pardon his son. So, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to say that he wasn't guilty of double standards, presumably, on this. I mean, why he has suddenly changed his mind.
You know what? I would disagree. I mean, I can't say what was in his head at that moment, but
it was unequivocal in that moment, though, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, if he said in that moment that he wasn't inclined to do it, then so be it, right? But that was probably also at a time in which he was seeking re-election. He ultimately is not seeking re-election. He is on his way out the door, and I'm sure that there have been plenty of conversations, and there's probably been more information that has come to light since ultimately that prosecution took place. Mind you, the president was very hands off with Hunter's prosecution. But now that Hunter has gone through it, now that there had to be a trial, there's a lot more that I'm sure that he has learned throughout the trial process and even afterwards. And so I think that he's entitled to change his mind, especially since circumstances have changed.
But why in that case should he deserve a pardon? I know that you're making the point about, you know, this is a father acting on behalf of his son. I mean, this is not a power that is available to any other family in the United States.
So let me give you an example. When we look at the laws, there's a lot of laws that are on the books that have been on the books for a very long time that haven't necessarily in practice been prosecuted. And so what I'm saying is that when I call this a political prosecution, and I am curious, as you are interviewing people, especially as you start to interview Republicans, please ask them if they know of another case in which someone had been prosecuted for having a drug addiction at the time that they filled out an application to get a gun.
To interrupt, Congresswoman, but on that particular point, I mean, you know, Joe Biden has made a great thing about trying to cut down on the access that people who are unsuitable to own guns to have guns.
Absolutely.
And, surely somebody lying on a form about their drug habit in order then to illegally get a gun. I mean, that's sort of Exhibit A, isn't it?
Okay. And listen, I absolutely agree that the president has been a fierce advocate as it relates to gun control in this country. But we are talking about two separate things. And I took a completely different stance on this particular case as it relates to him filling out the application while being a drug addict. And again, just so that your viewers are clear, my background is on the defense side. And so when I look at someone who has something such as an addiction, I look at that as just that. It is an addiction. And so to say that I am going to hold you to the same standards, because at the end of the day, anybody that has ever had to deal with addiction knows that the first step that you have to go through is, number one, recognizing that you have a problem. So yes, he was addicted to drugs, but in his drug addicted mind, he was someone that he wouldn't call an addict. And so those are things that I do think make this a unique circumstance. But beyond that, like, forget all of that. He never would have been prosecuted if his last name was not Biden. And that is the bottom line that I'm trying to make.
But so you presumably know lots and lots of people who have been convicted of tax evasion. He was also convicted of that. I mean, he's getting a pardon because his final name is Biden.
Yes. And I'm going to argue with you that, again, he most likely would not have been prosecuted even under these circumstances. As someone who serves on the Oversight Committee, we know that there was an investigation that was taking place for approximately 6 years, I think. It usually doesn't take that long. That's not how long. And so essentially what it was this continued pressure of, you know what, this is somebody who's a Biden. And mind you, they kept saying, we're trying to get to Joe Biden through Hunter Biden.
It's going to make it more difficult for you, isn't it, when Donald Trump comes in, as I'm sure the argument will be made that in some way, I mean, you know, we've had lots of warnings about how he might politicize the justice system. It's going to make that argument from the Democrats all the more difficult to make, isn't it?
I don't think so. Because, again, you're talking about the Justice Department. The Justice Department is completely separate from a presidential pardon. Right. We know right now that Donald Trump had pardoned one of his children's father-in-laws, who's now going to ultimately become an ambassador to France. But that is separate from the Department of Justice. We know that he has consistently taken those in his inner circle and given them passes and pardoned them from all of the people that got caught up the first time that he was in office. I still don't think that there's anything that this Justice Department did to politicize, because, mind you, Merrick Garland actually stepped back and allowed a Trump prosecutor to go after Hunter Biden. Now, let's see if Donald Trump will allow this DOJ to have, say, a Biden prosecutor go after someone in his inner circle. I can guarantee you the answer is no. So, no, I don't think that this is going to be a difficult argument for Democrats going forward.
And that was the Democratic member of Congress from Texas, Jasmine Crockett. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Last month, a 30-second ad for a car brand started airing, and it caused a certain amount of comment. For one thing, it featured no cars, just a diverse group of 8 human models in highly coloured attire and the tagline, "Copy Nothing." The boss of Jaguar said it was all about moving away from what he called traditional automotive stereotypes ahead of the launch overnight tonight in Miami of their brand new concept car. Ginny Buckley is a motoring journalist who's had a sneak preview.
I'm covered by quite a strict embargo until the early hours of tomorrow morning, but I did see the car at a briefing at Jaguar Land Rover's Midland Design Studio. This was several weeks ago. And in over 25 years as a motoring journalist, during which time I have seen many, many car reveals, I can tell you that no vehicle has made my jaw drop quite like this £100,000 plus all-electric new Jaguar.
Jaw drop in a good way or a bad way?
Initially, it was both. It's quite an extraordinary thing to see. I actually think the car is very fresh. It's very different. It was interesting because Jaguar Chief Creative Officer Jerry McGovern said to me that he believed the car will make people feel uncomfortable. It will polarise. And actually, it's going to do that in the same way that Jaguar's recent rebrand did. But goodness me, if the aim is to get people talking, they've succeeded with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things about, you know, that old cliche of all publicity is good publicity. But I mean, that ad campaign really did set some people's teeth on edge, didn't it? It didn't have any image of a car in it, but it just seemed to be trying a bit hard, didn't it?
Look, it was quite an extraordinary reaction. You know, Jaguar is reinventing itself as a luxury car brand, and they've done it in different stages. And first of all, they wanted to set the story for the brand and what they were going to stand for going forward in this new future. And then they would follow. And I think it was some of the headlines around it were extraordinary. And most of the outrage seemed to be centered around a film showing lots of different people in brightly colored clothes and no car, which made people like Elon Musk and Nigel Farage and Joe Rogan and quite cross. It all seems a bit ridiculous to me. Yes, there were elements of it that I'm not too keen on. The capital G and U in Jaguar plays havoc with my OCD. But I really like elements of the new branding. I love the brass elements. I love the replacement of that traditional Jaguar growler face with the J and the R. I think the whole thing looks fresh. I mean, Jaguar had to do a rebrand, and it had to be extraordinary and different, because it's clear that what they've been doing wasn't working. You know, they've been trying to set themselves up as a rival to large premium German car makers like BMW and Audi, yet they're not selling cars. You know, they only sold 64,000 cars globally in 2023. Jaguar Land Rover's total was 432,000. So their volume is similar to really small niche car makers. It's simply unsustainable. Their MD told me that with this reinvention, they're betting the house on electric. It's the road they're going down, and they had to try something different. And in the early hours of tomorrow morning, we'll see the car and we'll discover if the future is looking rosy for them and if this is going to work.
The motoring journalist, Ginny Buckley. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Now, what is going on in Syria? In one sense, it's difficult to know, or at least to know for sure. Independent journalists have long not been able to operate in the country. But it does seem that we can say with some certainty that the last few days have seen stunning advances by rebel forces in the north, that they pretty much routed the Syrian military, and that the civil war, for years seen as frozen, and frozen in favour of the president, Bashar al-Assad, and his Iranian and Russian allies, has now become superheated once more. And also that people in northern Syria are again turning fearfully towards the skies as Russian and Syrian aircraft try to pound opposition targets. One question we also wanted to look at was what, if any, role Turkey, Syria's big neighbour to the north, might be playing in all this. It hosts millions of Syrian refugees and also has long held big interests in which groups are exerting power in northern Syria. The Iranian and Turkish foreign ministers met in Ankara today to discuss the situation, after which the Turkish minister Hakan Fidan had this to say.
There are some issues that we do not want to face at the moment. In particular, we don't want to see further escalation of the civil war. Secondly, we don't want to see the killing of civilians, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, the destruction of cities by heavy bombardment. We don't want people to be displaced and to go to other places. On the contrary, we want displaced people to return to their homes. It's extremely important that the flow of refugees stops and is reversed.
Ömer Özkesilcik is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council in Ankara. He specializes in Syrian affairs. How is the Syrian rebel offensive seen by the Turkish government?
As of now, the Turkish main goals in Syria, in terms of having a political solution, is much more feasible now, as the approach to normalize Assad without any political solution in Syria is dead as of now. Everyone now understands that this is not a possible way forward. Secondly, the Turks have now much more hope for the refugee return, as most of the Syrian refugees in Turkey are from Aleppo. With the new situation, we can expect a huge number of Syrian refugees in Turkey returning home, which will ease the domestic pressure. And last but not least, the Turkish national security interest in terms of fighting against the Kurdish YPG terror group, which is the Syrian branch of the PKK, has progressed as well. For instance, the region of Tel Afar, where the Russians vehemently oppose any Turkish military operation and protected the YPG, is now cleaned by Syrian rebels from the YPG's presence, and there is no more threat from the region of Tel Afar, at least towards Turkey. And now Turkey has the momentum to even build upon this and to make further additional gains.
Right. You said this advances Turkey's interests. Is there any evidence that Turkey is directly, or maybe indirectly, supporting the groups that are involved in this rebel advance?
When finally Russia labelled Turkey an occupying force in Syria and demanded the withdrawal of Turkish force from Syria and demanded the end of the Turkish support to the Syrian opposition and declared basically the end of the Turkish normalization attempts with Damascus, the Turkish foreign minister stated, apparently Damascus does not want peace in Syria. And only after that was it that Turkey gave the Syrian rebels the green light. But after the green light, Turkey did not in any shape or form directly engage in the military activities. There was no direct military support, no direct air support or whatsoever.
You mentioned the millions of Syrian refugees that Turkey is currently hosting and the hopes that many of them who are from Aleppo may return. I mean, we're only on whatever it is, day five of this offensive, and obviously we've seen the Syrian Air Force with Russian air support as well, bombing areas that have fallen into rebel hands. It's a bit early, isn't it, to imagine that refugees will be thinking, great, that's it, we can go back.
Over 730,000 Syrian refugees returned back from Turkey to Syria. So Syrians apparently really wish to return back to Syria, but not to Assad-held areas, but to opposition-held areas. And I expect, as well as the Turkish government apparently, that many will return despite not having 100% security.
Right. If that were the case, would that also be linked with what you were talking about in terms of the Kurds and Kurdish militants who are in the northeast of Syria? They're allied to a group that's called the Syrian Democratic Forces, and they've in the past they've received American support. I think there are still U.S. troops deployed in the region as well.
The U.S. partners with the SDF parallel to the Iraqi border and has a military presence there and fights there against the remaining ISIS cells. And the Russians protect the YPG's presence parallel to the Turkish border. And the main issue for Turkey is the YPG in areas parallel to the Turkish border, ergo within the Russian zone of influence, not the American zone of influence. However, making things even more complex, the American financial and logistic and military support is not limited to the American zone of influence. It's also going towards the Russian zone of influence as the U.S. support sees the YPG and the SDF as a holistic group. And thus, we have this weird situation in which American supplied and backed SDF elements are next to Russian forces in Syria.
Umer Özkırsılcık with that view of what's going on in Syria from Ankara. 20 years ago, Hollywood stars, human rights activists and world powers rallied to protect the people of Darfur in Sudan. A notorious militia known as the Janjaweed, who went on to be accused of war crimes, was terrorising non-Arab communities. Now Darfur is again being scarred by ethnic cleansing, but the world appears to be paying far less attention. Two massacres last year in the city of El Janina were so vicious, human rights groups say it was possible genocide. They accused the militia that rose from the Janjaweed, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, the paramilitary group which has been locked in battle with the Sudanese army for the past 19 months. The people of Darfur are not just facing terrifying violence, but the spectre of famine. The UN's new emergency relief coordinator is Tom Fletcher, and he's just been to Darfur, the most senior UN official to get there since the war began. Almost no journalists have been able to enter the region, but our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, was able to travel with Fletcher and his UN convoy.
What's the importance of your visit into Darfur?
We've got to get on the ground and see what the needs are. So it is about starvation, but it's also about protection, because these civilian populations are under massive, massive pressure. We know about the epidemic of sexual violence, but we also know that they are being used as pawns in this terrible, terrible conflict.
All right, we can move. Okay,
Transport is here. Everybody mount up.
Now as we move in, we can see the soldiers of the Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary, which controls this part of Sudan. Some of them in their camouflage and topsy-turvy turbans, just kids. Allegations, too, that child soldiers are being recruited here.
Nadia from Honduras, radio check.
Traveling into West Darfur, it's hard to call this a road, just a dirt track cutting through this semi-desert. Very bumpy, very dusty, and desolate. The odd truck piled high with people and goods. And checkpoints here and there. Just a tent on the side of the road and a few men with guns.
Nous sommes à El Janina.
Oui. Okay, we're entering Janina now. Wow. There's still an acrid taste in the air. Smell. This place was burning. The shops are charred. The doors blown over. This is where gunmen went on a rampage. This is where a massacre happened. Looting, rape, killing, ethnic cleansing. Arab fighters, the Rapid Support Forces, their allies against non-Arabs. It's been the story of Darfur. No one lives in these houses now to tell this story. But before we came to Darfur, we visited a refugee camp in neighboring Chad and met some people who escaped from here.
When the war started, many bad things happened. It's difficult to explain. It's something that never happened in this world.
Did you see yourself?
Yes, I saw it with my own eyes. When we were fleeing, we saw dead people on the roads. When someone with you was shot, you couldn't stop to help them because you were running for your own life. You had to abandon them. My mother didn't die, but I lost my uncle, my auntie's husband. We don't know the whereabouts of my uncle to this date.
The RSF and their rivals, the Sudanese army, both deny they committed war crimes. Inside El Janina, the UN's first stop is a displacement camp here.
We are here because we want to listen to you. I know that this situation is very, very hard, very tough. I know that sometimes you must feel that the world has forgotten you.
The first speaker is a community elder, a white turban teacher.
In the past, yes, we have suffered a lot here in this camp. Yes, it's true that when the war started, some people supported SAF, some supported RSF, but we as IDPs here, we are neutral.
The UN recognizes General Burhan's government as Sudan's authority, and he's restricted the UN's access and presence. The NGOs based here told Tom Fletcher the UN had to do better.
My name is Tarek Riebel. I'm the head of operations for NRC in Sudan.
What is your message to the United Nations?
We believe that more needs to be done in the country. We see people starving. We see people dying. Even now with the floods, bodies have come up as just because they're recently buried. I mean, it's literally, it's so visceral, the suffering.
Tarek Riebel, head of operations for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Sudan, ending that report from our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet. She was in Darfur. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. The annual meeting of the leaders of the G7 group of industrialised nations is not a phrase to set the pulses racing, even here in the NewsHour offices, unless that is you're talking about the fictional G7 summit in Germany, which forms the backdrop to Rumours, a new movie by the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin. The summit's host is the German Chancellor, played by Oscar-winning actor Cate Blanchett, who takes her fellow leaders to a gazebo in the woods to thrash out a statement on an unnamed global crisis. She's also part of a leader's love triangle, of course she is, in an absurdist comedy that pokes fun at political leaders, including a US president played with no attempt at an American accent by the distinguished British actor Charles Dance. There are also subplots involving zombies, a giant brain and an AI chatbot. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy has been speaking to Cate Blanchett and director Guy Maddin. He began with the film's opening shot, what's known as the family photo of G7 leaders all together.
The G7 manages to come up with family photos every year that are more just latently and overtly and explosively hilarious. They just have such awkward looks on their faces, and just seeing these world leaders who are usually, you know, the big cheese in their respective spheres all together, and you can suddenly compare their heights and weights and their clothing styles, but they're all united by some alpine backdrop or seaside vista. I don't know. It's just odd.
Cate, your character, well, you had a lot of fun with her, didn't you?
Yes, no. I mean, absolutely. I think I was the only one. Well, Charles as well, Charles Dance, who wasn't playing their own cultural stereotype. And it just seemed like a fantastic way to approach the systemic failures of the world from a warm-hearted human place.
You seem tense. Do you think a massage might help?
This happens every time he drinks.
I love strong women! I love him too much!
I do tend to get a little caught up in the dramatics.
Germany caught up into dramatics. We've seen this before.
Well, it is very human, and relationships, and your character, of course, is one who has a relationship in the film with the Canadian Prime Minister. It's we're getting under the bonnet, things that we, I guess, sort of imagine or wonder what is happening at those big meetings. Was that an important part of this view, Cate?
Yes. I mean, I'd never read anything like it. I think the screenplay, and I think the film does as well, it really sort of deliberately and often perversely with hilarious results sort of shifts tone. It's partly a political satire, but then as soon as you think it is, it's a soap opera, it's a monster movie, it's a B-thriller.
We had to flee the gazebo. We were attacked by dark, shadowy figures. Protesters.
That's what I thought too at first. But they didn't have signs. They didn't chant any slogans, and if they objected to any specifics in our program, they didn't say so.
We always wonder what happens in the corridors of power, and often it's just people saying, can I have a cheese sandwich? You know, and I think that that was part of the thing I loved, is that once their assistants and then they hadn't were gone and they didn't have any mobile phone service, they didn't know who they were.
I mean, Guy, from your point of view, there's so much in this film that is unanswered. Cate referred to Charles Dance. I mean, it's the question I'm sure so many people have put to you. Why on earth cast Charles Dance, a great British actor, as a US president?
Why on earth not?
Exactly. Somehow a G7 movie had been insisting upon existing in our writer's room. But then suddenly I got terrified. I thought, good Lord, the US president's been featured in so many Hollywood films. And that's the one place where American presidents get to be diverse. And I just didn't know how to top what Hollywood had already done without repeating ourselves. And then Evan just said, oh, and the American president is British. It was the first idea we came up with. And then we just laughed, the three of us. So he was British, and it's never explained why he's British.
No need to. Cate, look, this is a very visual movie. It looks amazing. But language is really important, isn't it? I mean, not just this rather bland statement that they spend the whole movie working towards at the end, these sort of political vagaries. But you know, you've got this, I found it hilarious sequence where Alicia Vikander's character comes in and they're trying to work out what language she's speaking. It's obviously sweet. She's a Swedish actress, we know that. But they go through about a dozen different languages.
Det är en svart storm som nalkas.
She can only speak gibberish.
Bäraren av deras budskap.
Swedish.
She's just speaking Swedish.
For you, where does sort of the language fit into this film?
I think, you know, as you say, a lot of that bureaucratic speak is often designed to offend no one and achieve nothing. And so it can get very frustrating, I think, to Eddie around in it. But of course, it's very easy to judge these things until you're actually in the situation where you're trying to prevent a nuclear war and make sure that trade can still continue through war zones and across cultures. It's a really complex thing. I think it takes a lot of energy, actually, and a lot of selflessness to lead a country and a nation. And I think what I love about it is that even in the midst of this sort of apocalyptic backdrop, set upon by sort of these floppy antagonists who are self-pleasuring in the background, they don't know what's going on, they never lose their civility or their kindness to one another.
Well, look, it does rather sort of beg the question. You've taken the G7 as your sort of starting point. There are kind of competing political blocks in the world now. There's the BRICS, where you've got Russia and China. I mean, would that be a starting point for a sequel, perhaps, Guy?
It seems like this is endless. Do you remember those continuous towels? You probably don't have them in the UK anymore.
Oh, yes. They're very unhygienic.
Yeah, right. They just recycle the same stuff. It's sort of a mobius strip of linen teeming with germs. It seems to me like G7 summits are like one big continuous towel.
Kate, is there anything, I mean, you say, you know, it's difficult to be a leader.
I mean,
at the end of the film, it is not exactly uplifting, is it? You're handing out tote bags which have got cyanide pills in. I mean, there's a speech which is meant to be a sort of rousing speech. Is there anything we should take from this film positive about politics?
I mean, we all know things, really important problems and issues and challenges facing us as a species, get politicized incredibly quickly. And so the sense of the common responsibility and the common urgency to solve these things gets entirely ignored. And what doesn't happen is they don't fracture as a unit. And so it does become sort of like a family saga more than a political satire. I find it terribly tragic and quite endearing where they all get to by the end of the film. But it's like a fever dream. I think people have to go into it thinking more Buñuel than, you know, a documentary about the G7. And I think personally, I found it a relief to exist in that state of mind for a little bit. It's a little island of absurdity away from the actual terrifying absurdity that faces us all right now.
Kate Blanchett, and you also heard from Guy Maddern. They were talking to my NewsHour colleague, James Kumarasamy. That's it from this edition of the programme. For me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.